It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. Holly Brooks, a two-time Olympian and licensed professional counselor, recently released a documentary titled Winning at All Costs, Breaking the Silence on Athletes and Eating Disorders. On today's show, I'll chat with her about eating disorders and exercise addiction, conditions that affect athletes of all ages and abilities. Her message to everyone is, you are more than your results, performance reviews, and appearance. Although healthy eating and exercise make very important contributions to lifelong physical and mental health, like any behavior, they can be taken to the extreme. During our conversation, we speak honestly about what that extreme might look like, including acknowledging that people suffering from eating disorders have a higher rate of suicide than the general public. If you or someone you know is thinking about suicide, you can call the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988 or visit 988lifeline.org. Eating disorders are life-threatening illnesses. The Alaska Eating Disorders Alliance, or AKEDA, has resources and support groups if you or someone you know needs help. Keep listening for more on Outdoor Explorer. Welcome to Outdoor Explorer, Holly.
Thanks for having me. Excited to have this conversation.
So I watched your documentary on YouTube, and I know it played at the Beartooth about a month or two ago, and you had a panel discussion, which I missed that night. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to attend. But tell us a little bit about this documentary, where you got the idea for it, what kind of drove you to get it going.
Yeah, well, many years ago, I decided to go around to cross-country running teams at the high school level all throughout Anchorage and talk about the issue of fueling and what was then essentially known as the female athlete triad. I knew that this was a big problem in sport. And actually, at the time, I was going through my own infertility struggle, having not menstruated in a really long time. So, you know, I had a personal connection to it as well. And it was a opportunity to do something really productive with the energy that I had. So I went around to 8 high schools in Anchorage and essentially talked about fueling and the female athlete triad, which is this relationship between underfueling, and then potentially losing your menstrual cycle and then creating weak bones or having low bone mineral density. So those are the triad or the trifecta. More recently, it's been renamed Red S, which is relative energy deficiency in sport. And it's actually more inclusive of all genders. And it touches on the fact that it's not just, you know, fueling a period and impact on bones, but it really affects every major system in the body. And again, is inclusive of all genders. And so relative.
And if this starts in a young athlete, I mean, these are lifelong consequences, right?
Absolutely. I mean, with early intervention, there can be a reversal, right, of some of these issues, but early intervention definitely matters. So I guess going back in the story, I originally went and did the talk about the female athlete triad, and I think it was 2015. And then last fall, I went around to all of those schools again, essentially 7 years later, and partnered with AKEDA, which is the Alaska Eating Disorder Alliance, and talked about eating disorders and relative energy deficiency in sport. And the talks went really well. I had a lot of feedback, a lot of questions from athletes, and it was obvious that there was a huge demand for this type of presentation and this information. And it wasn't scalable for me to go to every sport and every club everywhere. So we decided to turn that presentation into a documentary. And that's essentially where the Winning at All Costs, Breaking the Silence on Athletes and Eating Disorders came from.
Mm-hmm. And who are the two women who started AKEDA? I can't remember their names right now, yeah, but we should give them a shout out for sure, right?
Yeah, a huge shout out to Beth Rose and Jenny Loudon. They are the co-founders of the Alaska Eating Disorder Alliance. And, you know, I think it's been about 3 years and they have increased support and training and education and resources for Alaskans with eating disorders, probably 10,000% or something like that. Because before we really had no professional organization tackling this issue. We have no higher levels of care, you know, meaning if people have eating disorders, all there are outpatient therapists, but we have no intensive IOP, which is intensive outpatient, or we have no PHP, which is partial hospitalization. I know we're kind of getting into the weeds here, but
no. I mean, it's important stuff. This is a big missing link in Alaska, isn't it?
Absolutely. And because of our geographic isolation, we know that we're underserved, or we don't have the resources for lots of medical issues. And, you know, eating disorders are very serious. You know, they have a really high mortality rate, actually. And it's something that I think the statistics say that 1 in 9 people in our population will suffer from a clinically diagnosable eating disorder. That doesn't count all of the people who have subclinical, you know, issues. And then also what we know is that athletes experience eating disorders at a rate 2 to 3 times that of the normal population. So we essentially have this huge issue. We're under-resourced. But thanks to AKEDA, the Alaska Eating Disorder Alliance, we have more, you know, training and information and all of that than we've ever had before.
And I know that a lot of your focus the documentary especially is on young people, which is really important because we want to get there in the beginning before you kind of spiral out of control. But eating disorders maybe, and I think this is probably a myth for the general population, can affect anybody at any time in life. Is that right?
Absolutely. I always say that eating disorders don't discriminate. And the way that the media portrays it is we often see skinny, blonde, wealthy, you know, white, yep, cisgender, you know, anorexic girls. And that's how we see it portrayed in the media. But again, they don't discriminate. They affect people of all ages. They affect people of all genders, all, you know, racial backgrounds, and essentially people from underserved populations. They have higher rates of eating disorders, but then they have lower rates of being diagnosed and actually being treated for those eating disorders.
Much like other health problems in our culture, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That kind of made me think, is it sort of a chicken and an egg thing of like, are athletes at a higher risk of eating disorders because they're trying to have a better performance versus the general population? Or did they already start? I guess maybe I should ask, what puts you at risk in the general population? And then is that the same as athletes, or is there this added layer of trying to have a better performance and thinking that it's dependent on weight?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, complicated question.
Yeah.
You know, eating disorders are a really complex mental health issue. And I always say there's a biopsychosocial root cause, right? And so we know that there are genetic predispositions, you know, and then we know that your individual, the way your individual mind works, your psychology and your temperament, right? Your, the characteristics that, that make you, you, right? Are, can be a risk factor. And then the social part is the environment that, that you're in, you know, there is kind of a contagion effect, right? Mm-hmm. For eating disorders. And so for eating disorders in general, I always talk about the biopsychosocial, you know, component, but then for athletes, I think you're right. There is this desire, you know, I call it the athletic aesthetic, right? People want to look the part, right? For whatever sport they're in. And then we did talk about how athletes can affect people across the lifespan. However, puberty is really the time when a lot of those eating disorders kind of reveal themselves. And that can be because of our changes, right, in hormones and our bodies. And, you know, athletes really care about performance, looking the part. And then we all know that adolescence is kind of an awkward time in general. And so, you know, people are very self-conscious, very caught up with how they're perceived by others and peers. So it's a really, really difficult time. Then, you know, plus we have pressure from coaches, and we have the whole diet culture component. So it's just, it really feels like a loaded gun, at some point.
The diet culture thing, what can we do about the diet culture thing?
Oh my gosh.
It just seems like it's gotten worse, you know, as the decades have gone by.
That's a huge can of worms. And whenever I'm in my office here working with someone, sometimes they get frustrated. They're like, why is this so hard? And it's like, well, you know, diet culture is, there are billions and billions and billions of dollars, you know, put into consumerism and, you know, these messages that we're told that we're not enough, right? Or that we should look a certain way, or we shouldn't have acne, or we should be a certain size, right? And there are lots of companies and corporations out there just waiting to make a profit off of our insecurities. And so diet culture is everywhere you look, you know, in terms of media and messaging. And it's really, really hard to get away from that. So we're just exposed to it all the time.
Is it going to change? That's what I want to know. Is it going to change?
Well,
or is there just too much money involved in this?
I mean, that's a good question. I feel like we're at this place where people are talking about it more than ever in terms of organizations and advocates and books being written and, you know, lots of social media about it. So we're at this time where there's a lot of advocacy and we're, you know, trying to break the stigma, talking about like diet culture and these issues. At the same time, we're also in this period of time where there's more pressure to perform than ever, when there's more pressure for early sports specialization, when NCAA just said, okay, you know, NCAA is not amateur anymore. And now the athletes have control over their name, image, and likeness, which you could say is maybe a good thing, but it also puts even more pressure on those athletes to perform in high school, right? At this time when their bodies are changing. And they're trying to earn that college scholarship. So I know we're getting into,
no, that's okay.
Topics, but
we could probably talk about this for 2 hours, I'm sure. So, let's first talk about eating disorders and the definitions of the different eating disorders, some that people will be familiar with and maybe a few that are kind of new to most people, because we've never really thought of them as being an eating disorder. Maybe first, let's start with, what is the difference between an eating disorder and disordered eating?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And essentially, someone's relationship with food, it exists on a spectrum. So if you have, you know, maybe the far left is is, okay, it's engaging in intuitive eating practices. It's listening to your body and following those hunger cues and, you know, not feeling shame or guilt when you eat something that isn't, you know, that diet culture doesn't deem, you know, healthy, right? But essentially when you eat intuitively and you follow your body's hunger signs and don't have any guilt, right? You essentially do what you want. Mm-hmm. And food can be celebrated and it's delicious and all of that. On the other end of the spectrum, you know, are people with with clinical eating disorders that meet the diagnostic criteria, right? And as I said earlier, this can be a very, very serious mental health issue. And there, you know, it has the second highest rate of mortality behind opioid addiction if we're looking at mental health illnesses.
I remember a few years ago, I heard that in the documentary, but I remember a few years ago, it used to have the number one, because of course you're including suicide and just dying from the effects of starving your body. But then I was surprised that opioid addiction has overtaken that. So that's also very sad.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, I think we've all seen, you know, how big the drug issue has become.
Right.
So I guess eating disorders have been surpassed, but you're absolutely right. I mean, some people, there are the physiological components of starvation and heart failure, but suicide is really one of the leading causes of mortality amongst eating disorders, because people are just so, so distraught and they feel so stuck in, you know, those disordered thoughts and behaviors. It's really, really sad. So those are the two ends of the spectrum. Then we have everything in between. And I would say disordered eating and disordered thoughts and behaviors are kind of in the middle, right? And I'm sure most of us have had, you know, thoughts about maybe not liking our body or feeling extreme guilt when we eat a certain way, or, you know, commenting about someone else's body, or trying to change our weight, shape, or size. And so it exists on this spectrum. You know, on one side, we have a healthy relationship. On the other side, you know, we have someone that meets the clinical, you know, criteria. And then we have everything in the middle and in between.
I'll save this question I have. Oh no, maybe I'll go ahead and ask it now. Are eating disorders, they're part of the obsessive compulsive family, aren't they? Is that correct? That's what I've heard.
Well, they absolutely can be. You know, there are different temperaments that, you know, maybe cause like more of the restrictive eating patterns. And then there are certain temperaments that cause more of the impulsive, you know, binge eating or, you know, bulimic, kind of tendencies. And so, but there definitely is some overlap between obsessive compulsive, you know, disorder tendencies and particularly anorexia. So people just being like very caught up in calorie counting and, you know, all of those things. And so, you know, people who have more of the restrictive tendencies, you know, typically tend to be more type A, right? And really, number oriented and detail oriented. And, you know, I always say that these temperaments can be really good things, right? Sometimes the same things that make us really diligent athletes also make people really quote unquote good, right? At engaging or, you know, interacting with their eating disorder. So it can be really complicated.
So I asked this question a while back and then we went down a rabbit hole, which is fine. It's totally fine. I love going off and finding other things, but okay. So let's go down the list of eating disorders and what they look like and how they're related to each other.
Yeah. So there's anorexia, which people, that's kind of the one that's like in the movies the most. And so that usually involves some kind of restriction, of food. And, you know, people always used to talk about how like if you were to picture someone who is anorexic, you would probably picture someone who is in a very small body. But we're learning more and more about what's called atypical anorexia, which, you know, people who actually meet the criteria or who are engaging in restrictive practices, but they are in a larger body. And so we're learning more and more about that, that it's not always correlated with body size, but it has more to do with restriction. Then we have bulimia, which, you know, is eating food and then engaging in some kind of compensatory mechanism to get rid of said food. Most people think, or probably are going to think automatically of purging, but it can be abuse of laxatives or diuretics. But then we also have compensatory exercise, right? And so, you know, bulimia, it might not involve purging at all. And so it might be eating food, but then, you know, working out for 5 hours to burn off that food and making sure that you're getting rid of it. Then we have binge eating, which is actually more prevalent. If you were to combine people with anorexia and bulimia together, binge eating is more prevalent than anorexia and binge eating. And it's essentially eating a large amount of food, usually quickly, and then feeling intense shame about it. Mm-hmm. So those are kind of the three main, I guess, quote unquote, main eating disorders that people are going to encounter. But it's not like they're in these like little, you know, boxes, right? What I see often are people who engage in restrictive practices and then they binge, right? Because they've been starving themselves. And then, you know, then they might purge, right? So these lines are really, really blurred. And it can get really, really confusing.
And they all come with different health consequences too, right?
Absolutely. Different health consequences for sure.
Okay. So then there is, I think this is the next one is orthorexia, right?
Yeah. And so orthorexia is actually not in the DSM, which is the diagnostic manual. And so what orthorexia is this predisposition or this preoccupation, I should say, with being healthy. And so technically it is not an official eating disorder, right? It's not in the manual. It's not a diagnosis. Because at this point, no one can agree on what the diagnostic criteria actually is. And from my perspective, I think orthorexic tendencies are so pervasive in our culture. I think I see components of orthorexic behaviors and thoughts in almost everyone. But for example, it's again, this preoccupation with being healthy. It's, I can only eat this. It's, hey, I need to know where my food came from. It's, that's a bad food. I'm going to eat these good foods. It's the moralization of food. It's, you know, maybe people thinking that they're a better person or something because they eat quinoa instead of, you know, the breakfast sandwich or something like that. And I say that, you know, in what's meant to be a kind way. But I think often we're seeing people that say they have all these allergies and intolerances, and sometimes they actually don't. But it's this desire to try to be healthier, right? And nothing against people who actually have those allergies or intolerances. But I almost call orthorexia the gateway eating disorder, because sometimes a lot of those tendencies start with just trying to do the right thing, right? No one can argue against trying to be healthy. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, I say in the documentary, all of a sudden your world gets smaller and smaller. All of a sudden you can't go out to eat. You can't go to a potluck. You can't go to dinner with friends if you don't know what they're going to be serving, right? You can't travel. Right? You travel with your own food, right? And so mm-hmm. all of a sudden, you know, those behaviors just get more and more restrictive. And at some point, it started off as this socially acceptable thing. I'm trying to be healthier, right? No one can argue against that.
Right.
It can go down this disordered path really, really quickly. And, you know, I get really concerned about that.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. We are going to take a short break, and when we return, you'll hear more from Holly Brooks, the two-time Olympian and licensed professional counselor who has released a documentary called Winning at All Cost, Breaking the Silence on Athletes and Eating Disorders.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
If you are just joining us, you are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. My guest today is Holly Brooks, a two-time Olympian and licensed professional counselor who has released a documentary called Winning at All Cost, Breaking the Silence on Athletes and Eating Disorders. Well, in my 30 years of coaching, definitely over maybe the last 5 or 6 years, I've seen a huge increase in that kind of behavior around eating. And what people say to me as a coach, and this idea of clean eating.
Yes. And like as if the rest of us were dirty.
Right? I know, exactly, like, exactly.
But that just shows how even the language is so fraught with diet culture, right? Do you want to be
it's
clean?
Moralization,
It's the moralization. I don't want to be a dirty eater, right? But yeah. Like, ouch, right?
I know, exactly.
Yeah.
And it seems like maybe where I first kind of saw this in public culture was in bodybuilders.
Yeah.
They seem to really be on that. They're restrictive in their eating, but also everything has to be so spare and you know, no spices, no butter, nothing like that. You know, you have a chicken breast and broccoli.
Right. Well, if you look at bodybuilding, it's an aesthetic, right? It's a competition to, you know, essentially like manage your physique and make your body look a certain way, right? And so people engage in all kinds of really, really unhealthy practices in order to do that. And so, I guess I'm just going to say, I'm not a huge fan of that. And I don't want to knock people's passions, but you know, I am familiar with what people do to their bodies and the kind of stress that they put their bodies under, in order to engage in those competitions, and those kind of practices are not without consequences. You know, it can be really bad for your body, and people are essentially screwing up their metabolism, for a really, really long time.
Well, and the irony of this, I think particularly you see it in bodybuilding, but, there's a discussion about it in triathlon as well in age group ranks. So people who are paying a bunch of attention to their training and their eating, yet they're using some sort of performance enhancing drug. And obviously we know about that in bodybuilding, but it is a big discussion in triathlon right now in the age group ranks.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people are fighting natural aging. people are, you know, they're wanting to perform at their peak, but where's the line, right? In terms of what is a healthy behavior or, you know, a healthy practice to put your body through. And so,
it definitely feels like, because this is one of the other things that, you do is that you work with a lot of high achievers, just think, you know, I love your slogan, you are more than your results, performance, reviews, and appearance. Yeah. And I love that. And it does seem that there's a lot of people out there who needs some mental health guidance on this, of what's happening around something that's supposed to be fun.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that people are, well, we know in sport, people are getting really serious at young ages. It starts with early sport specialization, right? And people becoming year-round athletes at age 9. You know, ironically, or not, maybe not ironically, we're seeing like higher rates of injuries, orthopedic injuries, in athletes at earlier ages. We're seeing high rates of mental health issues and burnout in athletes. You know, there have been lots of articles about a suicide epidemic. I think last year there were 5 female NCAA Division I athletes who took their own lives. And, you know, lots of articles looking into like, why is this happening? And a lot of it has to do with the pressure to perform and the perfectionism and being perfect. And, you know, these tendencies and traits are going all the way from that early sports specialization through, you know, NCAA and Division I collegiate sport, all the way to professional sport. You know, we've seen lots of mental health issues in, you know, the GOATs, the best in the world, whether it's Michael Phelps or Naomi Osaka or Simone Biles or Mikaela Shiffrin. And then just like you say, it has kind of permeated into age groupers and, you know, people really taking their sports, very seriously, right? Which I'm not against, to be clear. But I do question sometimes the practices and the behaviors that people are engaging in. Mm-hmm. You know, in order to achieve those results. And it can become, you know, very obsessive. It could be detrimental to other aspects of your life. You know, if people are engaging in or using performance enhancing drugs, that's that's a whole nother can of worms.
And there is the article I just read not too long ago. And I had talked 10 years ago to some USA triathlon officials. And we were talking about the prevalence of doping among age groupers. And they were like, oh, we just aren't testing for it, but it's high. All the top people basically are doing it, is what they were saying. And I don't want to say that because maybe they aren't, you know, but there's definitely with the, I guess a big one is testosterone, because it's very easy to get, you know, if you're a man and you have low T, as diagnosed by some GP, or they'll give you testosterone. Well, that's, you can't do that. That's,
it's not just men taking testosterone.
And it's not just men. I know that too. Yes.
Yeah. And you know, the hard thing about doping or performance enhancing drugs is that, you know, the tests and the practices to, you know, catch those people or actually have rules are always behind, you know, the science, because it just follows the money, right? And if people are willing to pay the money and to buy that performance enhancement or that increase, there are lots of people out there who are doing it. And I think, like you just said, in age group triathlon, it's almost become maybe normalized. So you have to have the full carbon bike, but then you also need to be engaging in all of these other practices. And at least to me, that takes away the joy and the intrinsic reasons why we engage in sports in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so I guess to me, that's really sad.
Yeah. Well, I actually did have a few points I wanted to talk about that you just hit on a couple of them all at once. So the first one we'll talk about then is the money people are spending as age groupers, or as a 9-year-old, their parent, how much money their parents are spending them to get them into camps and travel and all these things. Do you have any thoughts about that, about how much money people are spending to increase their performance. Triathlon's an easy one to pick on because you can buy speed in triathlon, both in terms of if you wanted to do something performance enhancing to your body, but also because you can buy a faster bike. So people spend a lot of money in that sport.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I think the amount of money that people are spending on sport, like I said, at an early age is just, it's crazy. But it also takes a lot of people out of the talent pool, right? I think we're probably missing a lot of our best athletes just because they can't afford to keep up, right? Right. There's this race to become identified, right? By coaches and talent ID camps and, you know, special academies. And, you know, again, I'm not against all of this, but I do think that it becomes really unfair quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just a lot of pressure to do all of the things. Mm-hmm. And so I know in our family, I really want to expose our kids to lots of different sports. And, you know, I see friends and clients who it's like fighting an uphill battle in order to have your kid in multiple sports, right? Because the kids have the social pressure to be with the team. And if you miss the boat, right, there's all this fear around missing the boat. And how can you ever, you can't be on that team seasonally if the team is playing year round. And
right.
You know, but then that leads to, again, injury and burnout in the kid. Mm-hmm. And there's so much pressure. I mean, the performance anxiety that I'm seeing, you know, across the board is just really, really crippling. Mm-hmm. for a lot of people. And it's sad, right? You know, there are a lot of athletes who maybe they started out loving their sport, but then as they progress through it, it turns out they're doing it to meet others' expectations, right, of themselves, or to try to get that college scholarship. And it becomes this thing that they don't actually love anymore, but mm-hmm. sometimes they do it out of obligation or because they're addicted to external validation and getting the attention and the love. And it's really sad. And I almost feel like I was protected against that in many ways, because growing up as a skier, I was a skier, I was a soccer player, and then I ran track. And so I was a three sport athlete growing up in Seattle. We didn't have high school cross country skiing, but it was something I did with my family. Mm-hmm. And I really developed this deep love and passion for it. And I didn't do it because I was good at it. In fact, it was very much the opposite. I did it because I loved it. And then because I moved to Alaska, and because I loved it, I started doing more and more and more of it. And then, you know, ended up getting pretty good at it. And so I'm actually kind of thankful that I, you know, wasn't identified early, and put down this track of early talent identification and, you know, only able to do one sport. And,
that's kind of where we followed the Soviets and the Germans, the East Germans started doing that first, right?
Absolutely.
And the Chinese too, I guess, started to identify these athletes, put them on a single sport from the time they were like 9 years old, yeah. And to create these powerhouses. And the United States wasn't really doing that. Yeah. And that's been a big change, I think, in our culture, because it used to be celebrated to be a multi-sport athlete.
Yeah. Yeah. And still, if we look at a lot of the top athletes right now, I think we're still, a lot of people come from a multi-sport background, but I think that that's going to start to change, mm-hmm. Just based on the direction, you know, our sport culture is going and the pressure to do so. And we'll maybe look at some of the best athletes and maybe they did engage in early sport specialization, but we're also not accounting for all of the other people that went down that path and then dropped out of their sport entirely, right? Because of, again, you know, burnout or, you know, only doing it for that external validation. So I'm a little cautious, you know, about what direction we're going. And I'm really ready, as a parent, to roll up my sleeves and to fight hard against that early sport specialization. Mm-hmm. I don't want that for our kids.
Well, I also remember just maybe a year or two ago reading some college football coach. I can't remember who it was. And he said, I won't take kids who have only played football. they have to have played other sports and done other things. They have to.
Kudos to that coach. That is awesome. And I wish more coaches would subscribe to that idea.
Yeah. I've seen here in Anchorage and more connected to the soccer community, things like parents being told, you can go on that vacation this summer, but if you go, you're going to be behind everybody else. And this was pressure put on a kid who was like 10, you know?
Right. And so all these young kids are being pressured to not go on family vacation.
Exactly.
Like that's, is this really the direction that we want to go? I mean, yeah. I would say no, mm-hmm. but the pressure is out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is definitely a lot of it, I think, is hooked to the money piece of it that, you know, people are making money, right?
Yeah, I can't remember the number, but it's like youth sports are, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars.
Yeah.
And it's a business.
Mm-hmm. Let's also talk about data tracking obsessions.
Well, people on the radio can't see this, but my sleeves are rolled up and
nothing on your wrist. I have a Timex Ironman on my wrist. That's all I have. Old school.
Absolutely. You know, just with this whole like data-driven obsession or obsession with performance and external validation, you know, comes Strava and Garmin watches and data points. And, you know, it's essentially turning our performance into numbers, right? And again, I'm not against numbers. I'm not against science or tools, but the way I see it is people are becoming so data-driven that they're losing the ability to actually key into their own body. And they're losing all kinds of like intuitive sense of training, right? Am I tired? Or, you know, am I like, what do I need to do? Right. And
yeah,
you know, I always just joke that people train and they just are constantly looking at their watch. What's my heart rate? What's my heart rate? What's my heart rate? Right.
Yeah.
You know, and people just have no clue. They're not in their bodies.
Right.
Anymore. And I think that is a really, really big problem. And then there's a tie to an eating disorder right there, right? If people are following a food plan, they're following their food plan and they're not actually keying into their real hunger cues, mm-hmm. right? Because the food plan says I can only eat, 382 calories and it has to contain these specific macros, right? And you know, people are totally becoming disconnected to their bodies in terms of food and exercise. And I think it's really, really unhealthy. And, you know, they're doing things to, you know, earn King of the Mountain or, you know, just the comparison, right, that a platform like Strava can bring on. It can be used as a tool or it can become a really toxic instrument that leads to things like overtraining and, you know, obsession and underfueling. Mm-hmm. So I am in retirement from my sport. I have been for 8 years and, you know, I have actually kind of not engaged in most of those platforms because I am more of that intuitive. I want to listen to my body, check in with myself. And that's, you know, one of the many skills that I try to teach my, mm-hmm. my clients. But it's really hard when I teach them that skill here, but then they go back into this environment, which is, you know, all about Strava and PRs and, you know, data-driven and you must do this to be fast. Mm-hmm. Right. I think that people are losing the ability to think for themselves.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. You know, I've been coaching for 30 years and been an athlete myself since I was 12, you know, or yeah. That's when I kind of got into organized stuff, 10 or 12. And that was one of the, when all the technology really started to bubble up like 15 years ago or 20 years ago when heart rate monitors came on. And I tried a heart rate monitor, you know, it was just very basic at that point. And it was like, this takes all the joy out of it for me. It's just like, this is not fun to monitor this. And am I hitting my marks, you know? Right. And am I a professional athlete or an Olympian? No, I'm not. So why am I so concerned about this? And so I also got rid of all those things. And that's the way I coach too, is like, you know, trying to get people to understand how their bodies feel and maybe go on pace rather than what a watch is telling you. Cause the watches aren't always that accurate either. There can be accuracy problems.
Absolutely. You know, and so, but people need to understand like rate of perceived exertion and what feels like. And again, I'm not against metrics, but I think that they should be used in conjunction with, not instead of, right? Like being able to feel things for yourself and having an understanding of what does hard feel like, or what does easy feel like, what does fatigue feel like, right? Instead of just trying to watch to tell you.
So kind of along that line too, what are some signs that someone has slipped into an exercise addiction?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, if they have a training plan and they're doing way more than their training plan, if they are exercising when they're injured, right? If I see a lot of people using exercise as their main coping mechanism, you know, for mental health issues, they lose, you know, their entire sense of self-worth is basically based on how much exercise they've done, right? Or, you know, what their rankings are in X, Y, or Z platform. You know, and so an addiction essentially is like an unhealthy, you know, dependence, right, on something. Like, and I think that exercise, for some people is becoming this, the one thing they do, it's their identity, it's their coping mechanism. And so I would say exercise addiction is if they're engaging in more than is beneficial to them, if, you know, and if they're letting it impact, you know, their job, their social life, their, you know, their ability to maintain relationships and stuff like that. Right. Like I can't go to family dinner. Right. Because I have to.
Got to get this run in.
Right. And of course we all know that there are sacrifices that athletes must make. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
To follow a training plan, but you know, there are people out there doing twice, you know, what they're two times the amount of what their training plan calls for. Right. And
what about like people who have, coaches who are prescribing too much exercise or too much training, I should say, like what would be some of the red flags you would see in a coach? Like I can say one, if a coach isn't giving you a day off, complete day off in during the week, that might be a red flag that your coach is giving you too much, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if a big one is if your performance is going down, right? Mm-hmm. And if you're so fatigued, right? You can't go about like the daily tasks of your life. If you're maybe unable to go hard, right? You know, and maybe if you have heart rate suppression, right? That can be a sign of overtraining. Circling back to relative energy deficiency in sport for menstruating individuals, if you lose your cycle, if you do have a natural cycle, and or birth control will actually force what's called a withdrawal bleed. So that can be a little nuanced, right? Because people can actually be having a quote unquote period, but it can be from the pill, right?
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
Overtraining and underfueling. So some people use that as false confidence. They're like, but I'm having a period, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about REDS a little bit. So with REDS, it was kind of this discovery that why women or girls aren't getting their periods didn't have so much to do with a lot of training, but had more to do with not fueling it enough, right?
Yeah.
Kind of getting that right.
Yeah, we talk about LEA, which is low energy availability. And so everyone has their basic metabolic rate, right? The food that you need for your heart to beat and your blood to pump. Uh-huh. Right? But then we also have what kind of exercise and energy demands do you have above that? And so Red S is essentially this, you know, this you're not eating enough to fuel your body for what you're asking it to do. So it can happen unintentionally. We see that in transition. You know, maybe high school athletes are going to college and all of a sudden they're doing twice the amount of exercise, but they're eating the same.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not making, you know, a change to their fueling strategy, right? Or
that was kind of the opposite of what I did in college. Yeah. Yeah. I decreased exercise and ate more.
Yeah. I mean, you never know. But yeah. What I see a lot here at the high school level is kids are going to high school practice and then they're going to club practice, right? And so they're actually doing a lot of back-to-back training. There might not be communication between those coaches. So they may be doing too much intensity and then they aren't fueling in between sessions, right? So they don't have the fuel before or after training sessions, you know, which can be really, really detrimental and lead to not only performance, it can inhibit performance and cause injury, but, you know, it can also cause red S. And then that can also in turn lead into an eating disorder or disordered eating. So
are you seeing the same prevalence among girls and boys?
If you look at all the research, there's much higher prevalence in female athletes or female identifying athletes. You know, and so I think that there's a bigger stigma for boys and men. But essentially, you know, once we hit puberty, in terms of a performance measurement, you know, men just kind of gain testosterone and their performance tends to be this linear improvement for girls. And, you know, people who go through puberty as a female, there can sometimes be a performance plateau, right? And Lauren Fleischman actually coined the term performance wave, right? Mm-hmm. Which I really love. And, you know, as a female, we need to go through puberty and get to the other side in a healthy way in order to create our bone mineral density for life, in order to have a healthy hormone profile. But sometimes that means that we can kind of plateau in our performance at this time when there's a lot of pressure to just get better and better and better. And so I think that that's one of the many reasons why we have a higher rate of eating disorders and disordered eating in girls. And then we also know that there is probably more pressure on our appearance and aesthetics as females as well. We're also expected to wear more revealing clothing, more revealing sport uniforms. I'm really thankful here in Alaska that the girls don't have to run in the buns or the bathing suit bottoms.
Yep.
Lauren Fleischman talks about that a lot in her book, and that, you know, the different uniforms that girls and boys are having to wear. The girls' uniforms are a lot more revealing. Now, why is that?
I know.
The sexualization of sport. And if they were wearing those buns for performance enhancement, the men would be doing it too, but they're not.
Exactly. I remember like early on, you know, I'm like the first generation of Title IX girls, you know, I got all the benefits of Title IX. So, but it was also this idea that, the pressure to feminize yourself as a girl and to be a girl, but I'm not sure if that's such a big deal anymore. I think girls are much more, relaxed about how they present themselves. They can, you know, be non-gender conforming and, you know, just dress the way they want and not to have to hyper feminize. So it's very uncomfortable for a lot of girls to have to run in those. I mean, they don't want to, you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, especially for trans athletes or non-binary athletes or, you know, people who are experiencing gender dysphoria can be really, really triggering. And so I'm thankful that there seems to be more options in terms of uniform choice. And we need to keep having these conversations. Make people comfortable, right, in their sport and in their bodies.
Because the goal should be that everybody gets to participate and that they feel comfortable participating, not that everybody gets to win. Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. Especially, you know, middle school and high school sports, it's, and especially sports that have a no cup policy. This is when we're teaching healthy habits for life. And, you know, hopefully there's a low, economic barrier, right? Mm-hmm. So the clubs and the camps and all of that stuff, that's really expensive. But this is why middle school, elementary school, middle school, and high school sports and PE are so important, because hopefully there's a very low barrier to entry. And we need people to be exposed to exercise and learning healthy ways to move their bodies.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that you're tight on time. I really appreciate you hanging. Let's go out with, we talked just touched on Lauren Fleshman's book, Good for a Girl. And I know that you really recommend that book.
Absolutely. It just came out a couple months ago. It has already hit the New York Times bestseller list. It's a fabulous read. And I hope that men will read it too, because we can't just be preaching to the choir.
Right. Exactly.
I'm just, you know, highlighting and saying, amen, amen. Right. But we need other people, particularly people in power and that have decision-making capabilities to be reading this sort of thing. And we need to change the toxic sport culture that exists. And I think we're starting to, but we need to keep having these conversations. So thanks for letting me talk about it today.
Yeah. Thanks so much for joining me today, Holly.
Okay. Thanks.
Before we go today, a few announcements. Allie Harvey, the Anchorage Daily News outdoor columnist and traveling artist who has been an Outdoor Explorer guest several times, is taking her mobile art studio on the road out of Alaska. If you want to check out the studio in her custom Airstream trailer before she leaves Alaska, she'll be parked at the Government Park Recreation Area on Friday, April 28th from 4 to 8 p.m. The tour of Anchorage Trail will be closed from approximately April 17th to April 30th, and then again from June 18th to September 1st for trail improvements. The first phase of work in April will be for trail clearing, and the second phase will be for the installation of 3 new bridges. The closure will affect the trail from the Campbell Creek Science Center to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue. Follow detour signs and watch for construction equipment. Joint Base Elmendorf and Richardson, better known as J-Bear, is switching to a new recreational permit program this year. If you recreate on any J-Bear training areas, which includes much of the Northeast Anchorage Chugach Front Range, and you want to learn more about safely accessing this land for recreation, there will be an informational meeting on Monday, April 17th at 4:30 p.m. at the Lusac Library in the Wilda Marston Theater. That's it for today's show. Thanks to my guest, Holly Brooks. You can find links to Project Red S and the Alaska Eating Disorders Alliance, including a link to Holly's documentary, Winning at All Costs, Breaking the Silence on Athletes and Eating Disorders, by visiting the Outdoor Explorer page on alaskapublic.org. The show was produced by Eric Bork. My name is Lisa Keller, and from all of our hosts here at Outdoor Explorer, thanks for listening, and we'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.